We have time. We have 15 minutes for a discussion, and I know that Pascal is not here, and she needs to load your presentation, I guess, if she did not done it already. She had done it already.
Yeah, in fact, that's
true. Yeah, no, I don't know if she was successful. But any question, clarification that you would like to ask to presenters just before we begin the discussion? Any comments on the presentation? I mean, Elizabeth, yes?
I have a question for the last presentation, which has to do with the management. That was one of your issues, management and governance. And so up to now, you have an organization that has enabled the change to be, or guided the change that is happening. Yet it raises the question, as you did with the pool project, of how is that sustained in the long term? Is there a point at which you envision that this community will be liberated of its guiding, of its beginning guider your initiative? How is that set up?
It'll certainly be liberated from the group of us that set this project up. The co-ops, of course, themselves have already taken control of their housing. We, from time to time, had new members to the organisation, new trustees. They must live and have lived for at least 3 years in the local area to qualify. But it is seen as really something that will continue. More and more of our work is, if you like, managing and running projects rather than building. You don't need many staff to build.
But this organization will continue in some neighborhood association fashion, some governance fashion.
Yeah. And it was basically a grassroots NGO bottom up, which posed or raised a question whether future governance system may not be imposed from the top, but rather from the bottom up. Are we for a mayor, shall the strategy will be let them not control and empower local groups? What do you think about that?
Empowering is very important. I mean, my own take is that, you know, we need people operating at different levels, and one of our jobs has been to link national, metropolitan, London-wide, local government. In fact, it's easier for us to talk to those different levels than it is for them to talk to each other, because our national government thinks the local government, you know, is just a servant of theirs. So, you know, part of our job is integrating that sort of level, not yet on an international scale, I'm sad to say. But the other job is integrating, if you like, at a horizontal, the businesses, the various sorts of organisations that are in the area. And it's that integration, I think, that's at the heart of what is, for instance, possible.
We have with us Carmen Ball from the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. Is the Canadian system a similar in nature? We cities like to empower NGOs, or it's we have a different management structure where it's a top-down more or less. What is your experience in the Canadian context, although you cannot speak about large countries like Canada, but what is your experience from working with municipalities?
Also, our federal, provincial, and municipal governments trying to work together in an effective manner. The Federation of Canadian Municipalities works with municipal governments, so local governments, and our main function is to work on behalf of our municipal governments, advocating to the federal government. But I think what we're seeing here in Canada is a large uprising of the smaller NGOs, groups like yours. Here that are really pushing on and really encouraging a lot of people and forcing groups like FCL and others at this level to really rethink the way that we all work together.
Paul, mm-hmm. What's
yes, I want to congratulate you. He's a hero. He can be very modest in terms of political
could speak a bit louder. People would like to hear the back. Please, please, please. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
I would say that Ian is a hero and a modest hero, but he's a product of what happened. And the enemies they made, not only in local, but in the church, local architects, local residents, felt that their achievement by very important group.
Also exposing some aspects of their own work that they're not capable of doing themselves.
And it is international. In fact, it's a lot of places in the exotic international. It's not capable. The idea that a small group of people have had a lot of interference by the curriculum. And they simply said, we need to survive, and they said, we don't want to. And they stayed on the right side of the wall because they changed the law. Laws change with peoples. And I have to say, in recognition, the fact that they might be different has to be sense of colour. And you would see that many similar colours, and in Europe, and elsewhere, are in fact the German countries who stay there and not be bullied by those selfish groups. Who wanted the site simply for their own financial gain, to produce housing to allow the existing community to stay.
Wonderful. I wanted to ask Elizabeth with regard to your presentation in the launches. Unless there are other comments, please, Peter, go ahead.
Sorry to ask Elizabeth a
sort of
question, which I think applies to the whole discussion. And that is, when you set out new urbanism, how do you establish the goals that you're trying to achieve? What are the goals? And can you measure at some point whether you've been effective in achieving them? And then how do you deal with the fact that those change over time, that people's usage, desires, can be completely different in one way or another, and then we alter goals or are the goals they are fundamental things. Are you trying to make comfortable people to live there? More comfortable, more economic, commercial people? What is it that you are trying to achieve?
The goals are very broad. And they were first articulated in the Charter for the New Urbanism, which initially started out, the first line is seeking alternatives to suburban sprawl and urban disinvestment. There was an understanding that those two conditions were related, which at the time, in the 90s, was not evident to everyone in the United States, and probably still is not. We had the condition that in some cities, in some metropolitan areas, where the population might have remained the same in several decades, nevertheless, the city was decanted, and it was the suburbs that received that quantity. So then the charter goes into other goals and ideals that are about livability and sustainability. I think we've known about these goals for a long time, and we were also looking at historical settlements. So I believe those goals are, we believe they're timeless. How they are worked upon might change from decade to decade. It was an enormous fight in the beginning to think about policy changes at the local levels. Mixed use and urban were bad words, and transit in many cities was a kind of a joke. No one, who would want transit? And now you find that in those same places people are saying, why isn't the transit here already? But the goals, I think, are still useful.
Yes. Stephen and then Larry. Stephen?
Yep, on that point and to Ian, one of the things I was so impressed by even in the presentation was the real emphasis on affordability through the co-op model. We often see in North America, in many of our new mixed-use developments, they're generally speaking, are quite expensive. I mean, you pay a premium to live in these developments, generally speaking, compared to others. And there's much less of a cooperative, affordable angle. Is that a typical situation in London as you described, or is this qualitatively different there as well?
It is different. There hasn't been a lot of building of family houses in the centre of London for a long time, because it's always cheaper to do it further out. But then not too much further out, because the wealthier boroughs don't really want, you know, the poorer people moving amongst them. So the issue of affordable housing has in fact gone right up the political agenda recently, because there's a realisation that people just cannot afford the sort of prices that the market in London has. And how that's going to be resolved will be interesting. The sort of government has tried to build it off the back of private developments by saying, you know, you've got to have 50% of your homes affordable, but it's not wholly worked.
It's also affordable like London scheme.
Yes,
yeah.
It is.
There is a problem. I mean, our housing is, about a quarter of the price that you would pay on the market. And, you know, in a way, you need to have more levels. In fact, I some time ago heard of a Canadian cooperative model which mixed, a fixed number of homes, but I think a quarter of them were, market, a quarter of them were sort of really low rent, and the other half were sort of in between. I don't know whether that still exists, but I'd be very interested to find out.
Cooperative models do exist in Canada. We are still a cooperative. Yeah, it's a very strong cap.
But when you say non-profit cooperative, what does it mean to the end user?
Well, the people who move into our new homes are just ordinary people. Half of them are nominated by the local council, half of them directly by whichever route you come. You have to be judged in housing need, and because there's still too many, we have certain priorities, people in low-paid employment, people with connections in the area, people who live in co-ops need to transfer the three that we have. Before they move in, we put on it's an 11 three-hour session training, because people need to know what it is to be both a landlord collectively and a tenant. Because the landlord, has got to collect the rent, he's got to manage the property, he's got to allocate any homes that come free. So you have responsibilities, but with that comes the power. So they set their own rents, and they've obviously got to set them high enough. But that's how the co-op model works.
Peter, you want to buy into what's it?
Yeah, I was wondering, Liz, in some of the new urbanist communities that have been built, have there been, I know of a couple, but I'm just wondering what sort of surveys about how people actually are, traveling, or how well they know their neighbor, all that, it seems like there could be a tool developed, and I'm sure there has been, and we've talked about this a little bit, but, where some questions align with each of the charter principles are then used as an instrument for evaluation post-occupant. Is that the...
That would be, I think that's something that all of us would look forward to. In fact, there is remarkably little research in our world, in the United States, that's done on communities. The measurements tend to be related to technology rather than behavior. And so there is a broad area of opportunity there, and I think up to now much of the work is being done based on observation. But I think, as someone pointed out last night in one of the conversations, we can't wait for the data. In our arena, you just have to keep going. Nevertheless, it would be interesting to move beyond observation, as you have in some of the technological areas.
Most of your clients, are they land developers or municipalities? How will you segment most of the people who come and do fruition design? Were they land developers, private sectors, who knew of your work and came and engaged you, or you got the call for cities and municipalities?
The first steps, that first social, the steps of social marketing were the private sector. In the remaking of either downtown's areas, such as Ian describes, or this new arena of the suburbs, sometimes the most effective is a not-for-profit. And there might be quite a variety of them, but they do look, they do depend on government funding and subsidies to a great deal to be effective, as well as to, private involvement in actually carrying out the projects. So the non-for-profit also in the United States has the advantage of being not exactly suspicion-free, but somehow more amenable to public opinion than government or development, which are both seen with suspicion.
No, I believe that this is the greatest the advantage of being able to convince the private sector to do something that makes sense. Yes, last comment before we move to the next presentation.
Actually, a short question I wanted to ask Ian. In that respect, you were for the support of your organization, you were not operating on your own. And you already mentioned that you worked with municipalities, but also private developers coming together with you. How was the collaboration with private developers? Was there also some sort of saying of local population in what they need for the development?
We haven't teamed up with a private developer to do our own developments. We thought we would have to do the Oxford Fair scheme because we hadn't got the track record, it was a lot of money. In fact, we found that their requirements, which putting in equity, meant they wanted to get in, put rack rents, and get out quickly. And that just didn't sit comfortably with our much longer term vision. So in the end, with difficulty, we managed to borrow the money off the banking system. And once we'd done that, then we were able to borrow, like I guess any other developer, but we had assets and track record. So the work with other developers has been really for outside of our, outside of our immediate state.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. The next presenter is by